Okay, Tom and I were just remarking that it was probably a good thing we were ahead of schedule, because this agenda item may take a little time. I do want to kind of lay out that this is the House version of the reauthorization. There will be a Senate version that will come along as well. We really don't want to get down too far in the weeds, but most importantly, what we do want to see is what we all agree upon. So when Tom and John and I are at CCC in another couple, 3 weeks, we can bring a position to the CCC. So as I reported earlier, the executive committee did have a significant discussion last week and drafted a position document for the council to review today. Tom's going to go through it, and then we'll take questions, and then we'll there's in your documents, there's a draft council comments on the discussion draft, and we can go through that piece by piece. So I'll turn it over to Tom.
So I'm going to give a short presentation on the House discussion draft for Magnuson-Stevens reauthorization. If you're in your binder, under tab one, I think, there's a number of items that you may want to dig out. Item number two is the actual language of the discussion draft, which is pretty lengthy. We have some comments that we received from Dr. Pierce, Massachusetts DMF. There's a memo from me, and one of the attachments to the memo is some draft council comments that were agreed upon by the executive committee at the executive committee meeting. Those are all under item 2, labeled 2, 2A, 2B, and my presentation, I think, is 2C. So this is the year that the Magnuson-Stevens Act will be reauthorized. The first draft language that we've seen is coming out of the House Committee on Natural Resources. This is labeled as a discussion draft bill, and this is the first language we've seen. Some of you may be wondering why we're talking about this when there is a council prohibition on lobbying Congress. I just want to point out that the chair of the committee has forwarded the discussion draft to us and requested comments from all the councils. This is about the second or third time that the House committee has indicated to the council chairs and executive directors that they are soliciting comments on the draft language.
Again, I'm juggling the screens here.
As I mentioned, this is the first language we have seen. We expect to see this change over the course of the year. We expect to see a Senate version, and there is a possibility that the administration will actually prepare a draft version. We have a little bit of idea of what the timing will look like on some of those things, very preliminary, which I'll go to at the end of the presentation. We expect that the Council Coordination Committee, which consists of the Council Chairs, Vice Chairs, and Executive Directors, will probably discuss the discussion draft at our February meeting. And so it's helpful for those of us who attend that meeting to have some sense of what the Council thinks of the discussion draft so we go in the room and we're not just talking about our own personal opinions. Based on the Executive Committee meeting the other day, we suggest that what the Council really wants to focus on at this point is the broad concepts that are in the discussion draft. We expect the language is going to change a lot over the course of the year. We'll probably use the council comments, assuming we come to agreement on things, a couple different ways. We'll use them to guide our discussions at the CCC meeting. We can also provide the comments to the House committee staff, should the council wish to do so. We have had some discussion about Magnuson reauthorization over the course of the year. It started with a brief discussion at the council at the April council meeting in order to provide some input to Rip Cunningham, which he presented at the Managing Our Nation Fisheries Conference in May. And then over the course of the summer, Rip was asked to testify to the Senate. Rick Robbins was invited to testify to the House on behalf of the councils, and so we also provided additional information to Rick to help him with his testimony. We've said a number of things. Just generally, we've said more flexibility in rebuilding was supported. We asked for narrowly defined exceptions to the requirement to end overfishing immediately. This was in part based on our experience with Gulf of Maine cod and some other stocks. We asked for clarification on the overlap between the NEPA and the Magnuson-Stevens Act. We asked for some clarification of how National Standard 1 and National Standard 8 are supposed to be balanced against each other. We requested some modifications to the data confidentiality restrictions because of concern that the restrictions are so severe that they prevent information from being used by council members when necessary. And in one other thing, we asked for an acknowledgement in the Act to allow the U.S. Coast Guard access to VMS data for safety reasons, which right now is technically prohibited by the Act. Now, of these things, I think that there's only one that isn't addressed in some fashion in the discussion draft, and that is that it seems not to address this issue of what is the balance between National Standard 1's requirement to end overfishing and achieve OI and National Standards 8's emphasis on the impacts on communities. That seems to be the only thing that is not in the discussion draft. My discussion will go into the 8 or 9 broad overviews that broad sections that are contained in the draft. I'll go into a little bit of detail on each of these. I'm not going to go too far into the specific language except when I need to. What the executive committee did, if you're looking at the attachment to my memo, is they went through these similar sections and they developed some broad statements on the topics that they recommend the council adopt. We're trying to avoid wordsmithing. Anyone who has done it realizes that with 18 people, we could be here until Christmas if we try and wordsmith this. But we tried to focus really on the broad concepts that we think the bill is trying to get at. Now, if you've read the discussion draft, you probably have some questions about some sections, as we did, as to what exactly is the bill trying to get at. And fortunately, between the executive committee meeting and this meeting, Chris Kellogg and I were able to get a hold of Dave Whaley, who is the lead staffer on the committee who worked on the draft. And he did help clarify some of the items in the bill, though not all of them. But I think the one important thing to note here, and this will perhaps address a lot of your questions, is that none of the provisions in the discussion draft are intended to remove requirements to end overfishing, and none of them are intended to remove the requirement to rebuild overfished stocks. Now, they may modify those provisions to some extent, but they're not intended to remove them. So if you're reading a section of the Act and you say, oh, okay, does this remove the need to meet a rebuilding target? The answer is no, it doesn't. And there are some sections where you can legitimately ask that question, I think. And if you're reading a section of the draft discussion draft and you say, does this remove the requirement to end overfishing? Again, the answer is no. That is not the intent of the discussion draft. Now, obviously, things can change between now and when we get to a final bill. But I think if you keep that in mind, it will help you interpret some of the sections that do not seem to be as clear as you might think they could be. And to be honest, if that's the case, in some instances, when you read our comments, you'll note that we said we don't think this is real clear what it is you're trying to accomplish with this particular section. So with that as the lead-in, I'm going to summarize the main sections. And again, I'm not going to go into terribly much detail, but I want to give you a flavor. One of the key sections in the Act is that it increases flexibility in rebuilding requirements. There are some phase-in requirements for rebuilding plans for something that the discussion draft calls a highly dynamic fishery. Without going into a lot of details, the draft does modify the timing for the fixed rebuilding period, but it does not remove it completely. It also provides some exceptions to the rebuilding period based on several criteria. So, for example, there's some exceptions to the time period if it's going to cause significant economic harm, or if it's the stock is at a low stock size due to non-fishing causes or unusual events. But this section is perhaps the first one where you need to keep in mind that the flexibility doesn't mean you're getting rid of the requirement to rebuild an overfished stock, or I should, to avoid confusion, because this will come up in a minute, refer to a stock at low stock sizes. There is some language in this section that refers to alternate rebuilding approaches. We struggled to understand what that means. Chris and I raised that point with Dave Whaley this week, and we're still struggling to understand what it means. It's not real clear to us what that section does or whether it would modify the way we've treated rebuilding in any of our management plans. So I really can't clarify that particular section. The next section is that there are changes to the annual catch limit requirements. Some of these are pretty notable, but you have to read them, keeping in place my original caveat. They don't get rid of the requirements to end overfishing. They don't get rid of the requirements to rebuild stocks that have low stock size. It includes a section that says you're allowed to consider ecosystem and community needs when setting ACLs, but keep in mind what I just said. It goes into some language that is currently in the National Standard Guidelines, and it incorporates it into the Act, where it refers to ecosystem components, defines what an ecosystem component is, tells you whether you do or do not have to make an ACL for an ecosystem component. Generally, you do not. There's some language that talks about stock complexes and multi-year ACLs. This is an interesting one because at first blush, when you read this, it sounds like this might overrule the requirement to rebuild individual stocks of fish. It does not. Okay. So, again, when we talked to the House staff, we struggled a little bit to see how this is terribly helpful section. You're allowed to create a stock complex ACL, but that doesn't remove the requirement that you have an individual stock inside that complex that's overfished, that you're still required to rebuild it. Nor does it allow you, generally speaking, to allow overfishing on one stock in that stock complex. So we were struggling a little bit to understand how that could work. With respect to multi-year ACLs, this is something that we already do in large measure, but there is a sort of a subtle nuance that I don't think is well spelled out here. The intent of this is to allow the possibility that you could, in essence, average 3 years of ACL, so you have a similar ACL for all 3 years rather than having it increase or having it decline. And it's not clear to me how this would really match with the requirement to end overfishing. Now, one thing that we did learn from talking to Dave Whaley that we kind of missed when we talked to the executive committee, and Rick pointed this out to us as well, is there's a not-so-subtle change in the Act that says that the annual catch limit cannot exceed the overfishing level recommendation of the SSC. The Act currently says that you cannot exceed the fishing level recommendation, which has been interpreted to be the ABC. So this would allow the setting of an ACL that would be between the ABC, for example, and the OFL. You would have to justify that, of course. You would still have to meet rebuilding requirements. But there may be times when, due to economic conditions or ecological conditions for a stock that is not in a rebuilding program, that you might be able to justify setting your ACL somewhere between that level. It would give the council some flexibility to set higher catches under certain conditions. Now, as is always the case, all of this stuff is going to require interpretation and the National Standard Guidelines, and we don't really know how all this is going to be interpreted. There is a change that a lot of people have argued for years, in that the Act introduces a different term rather than overfished to refer to low stock size. The language that's proposed in the discussion draft is to refer to those stocks as depleted. This is not only a new term, but it requires that the agency identify when low stock size is due to some other cause other than overfishing. Here's a section that many of the council staff are kind of hoping something happens here. There's a section that talks about transparency and NEPA. There's a couple pieces here. The first is that this could prove to be one of the most contentious sections of the discussion draft. And it's not because of the requirement for transcripts and perhaps video of council and SSC meetings. The Act proposes that councils be required to increase access to council meetings and SSC meetings. This kind of caught us by surprise because, as you know, we try and webcast all our council meetings and many, if not most, of our SSC meetings. There's a requirement here that video be available. I think some of this may get modified a little bit down the road. It turns out that not every council makes access to their meetings as readily available as some other councils. And so that's what sort of prompted this to be put in place. But the more important part, and the one that is likely to be more contentious, is that there's a paragraph in here that says, if an action is prepared in accordance with the Magnuson-Stevens Act, it's deemed to comply with NEPA. And this is, frankly, an attempt to try and streamline the management process to simplify and to get rid of some of the overlaps between NEPA and the Magnuson-Stevens Act. I think the logic here is that the goal of NEPA is to make sure that a federal agency has the information in front of them needed to make decisions and that they consider alternatives, ways to accomplish what they want to accomplish. And this, in large measure, is exactly what the Magnuson Act requirements are for fishery management plans, that the councils consider alternatives and that the information and analysis be available when the council makes a decision so that they can make these decisions. There was, frankly, an attempt in the last reauthorization. There was direction given to the agency to streamline the overlap between NEPA and the Magnuson-Stevens Act. Most of the council executive directors feel that effort has actually fallen short and has not simplified things at all. But the idea here is that this would simplify the preparation of fishery management plans, which might speed the process. It would also get rid of some of the conflicts between the timing in the Magnuson Act for document review and the timing in NEPA and that sort of thing. There's a section that talks about new catch share programs. In large measure, it removes some of the language that was in, or replaces some of the language or that was in the previous version of the Act, which refers to LAPs and IFQs, primarily with the referendum language. So for starters, it expands the requirement to a referendum to any catch share program, including a sector, if it's a new sector program, for example. It also modifies some of the provisions. Rather than a two-thirds majority, two-thirds vote in New England, it simplifies it to a simple majority, which is very similar to what it was for other regions. We had a question about whether it limited votes to active permits. We don't think that's the intent of the language after talking to the House staff. There's a section in there that talks about if a permit is not fished for 3 of 5 years previously to the referendum, then the permit owner can't vote in the referendum. The intent is that fished means if the quota associated with that permit is harvested by anybody, that permit owner would be allowed to vote. The concern here is somebody who takes a permit, sits it on a shelf, and doesn't allow the quota attached to it to be fished at all for 3 of the 5 years. In an effort to make all the requirements similar across all the regions, the draft document takes out a provision that was in the current Act, which says that in New England, the regional administrator will consider allowing crew to vote. So that explicit reference to crew voting is taken out of the statute. It's a little unclear whether that means you could not let crew vote, but this may be an issue. And when you read the executive committee comments, you'll see at the executive committee this was an issue that they thought worth highlighting. There's a fairly lengthy section on data collection and confidentiality. It makes a number of steps to try and increase the speed with which electronic monitoring might be adopted. It allows at least the potential for VMS to be used for safety purposes, assuming the Coast Guard Commandant and NIMS can come to agreement on some sort of memorandum in order to allow that. There's an explicit prohibition that says data collected cannot be used for marine spatial planning purposes. This section is hard to wade through, and it's a little difficult to figure out exactly what this section is doing and what the intent was. To be honest, it doesn't seem like it makes it easier to use fishery data for councils. So I'm not sure it really gets at the one point that we tried to raise before. There's a bunch of other issues, some that I'm not going to go into because they don't really apply to us. They are more region-specific. One is that this act would make the liaison, our liaison to the MID and the MID's liaison to us, would now be a voting member of the council and would be allowed to vote on actions rather than just be a presence at the table. The discussion draft clarifies the relationship between marine sanctuaries and the councils. It makes it clear that any fisheries restrictions that are adopted for a marine sanctuary have to be adopted through the MSA process. This is something that I'm not sure it's been just an issue for us, but this periodically comes with us with relation to the Stillwagon Bank National Marine Sanctuary and whether the sanctuary rules allow the sanctuary to impose fishing restrictions within the sanctuary boundaries. If this were adopted, it would be clear that that is not allowed. Similarly, but not quite the same, there's a section in here that says that if fishing restrictions are needed as part of an Endangered Species Act recovery plan, they would have to be implemented under Magnuson-Stevens Act authority and timelines. So with that said, that's sort of the very quick overview of the discussion draft. The rough timeline, so far there's no Senate or administration draft available for us to look at. There is a House hearing scheduled for February 4th that I believe Chairman Robbins has been asked to testify at again. Tentatively, there may be Senate hearings. One was supposed to be later this week on the 30th and another February 27th. Those are tentative. The House committee is expecting to start marking up the document in March, which, of course, would be before our April council meeting, and we do not expect to be discussing this issue at our February council meeting. So that's kind of the overview of the discussion draft. I can answer any questions, but to some point we can answer questions because there are some things in here that, frankly, we don't necessarily understand what the motivation was, and we're not real clear on how to interpret some of the language. So between Chris and I, we'll try and answer your questions, but we're not sure we're going to be able to. And then at the pleasure of the chair, we can go over the draft council comments and maybe go section by section as we go through that if the council wants to, just to see what people think of them.
Okay, I see a lot of hands. Questions only before we go for the discussion. We'll start with Mark and go right around the table.
Thank you. Thanks, Tom, for that. I heard you say that there is a provision in here which would allow council to set an ACL higher than we otherwise would for, I guess, ecological considerations. And my question is there any provision that would allow a council to set a fishing mortality rate on a particular stock or stock complex above conventional overfishing definitions? So if we believe that ecosystem-based management is the holy grail we're trying to get to and that we have a system that's out of balance, I heard you talk about the constraints that would have to be imposed on an aggregate fishing process for the so-called choke stock, but if you don't have the companion opportunity to deliberately drive a stock that's in very high abundance down, you may not be able to get to the balance you're looking for. And I understand there's some hubris in thinking that we can do ecological engineering and achieve a balanced, an outcome balance that we think is favorable, but I'm wondering if there's anything in there that would allow that.
I don't think so.
Mary Beth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Before we get to the discussion draft from the committee, I think if we know what we're doing, are we making a decision to just provide you all with the information you need to go to the Council Coordinating Committee, or are we actually considering, you know, providing comments to the committee chair that he's asked for? Because those are two very different discussions in my mind. So do we know which direction we want to go in?
I mean, the executive committee has made recommendations for the council to consider, and I think what we're looking for is council review of these recommendations, and with once we have recognition of what if and what the council has consensus on, we can take that to the CCC meeting in February.
So the executive committee is not necessarily recommending that we provide a letter to the chairman of the subcommittee in the House.
The House staff is very interested in individual counsel comments. If the counsel is comfortable enough providing them. I don't know what's going to come out of this meeting, so it makes it difficult to know if we're going to have enough of a consensus that we want to do that. The issue, to some extent, when we deal with the CCC, we have eight councils, and so while we often come up with CCC positions, at times, because we don't all agree on everything, sometimes they either get watered down to achieve a consensus statement, or your point may not be, an individual counsel's point may not be given as much weight as that counsel would have originally appreciated. An example of that that I'll use is from last fall, where many of the councils agreed that we should have flexibility in ending overfishing. Two or three of the councils were more specific about what that meant to them. And when the draft CCC letter came out, the letter was vague. It said the councils think we should have flexibility in overfishing. And, you know, so some of us said, in ending overfishing, you know, and so some of us said, well, we think you should be more specific, and the answer is no. This is the 30,000-foot level that we're looking at. We don't all agree on the specific language, so we need to keep it vague. So, you know, if we send our own letter, if we have a position to the House, then I think we can be more specific about exactly what it is we mean.
That help you out, Mary Beth? Sort of. Mike?
Yeah, I have some comments, but first just the question. Is there a consolidated draft, that is, a draft that integrates or consolidates the changes with the existing language so one can actually read a text and sort of get the flavor for the whole thing? It's pretty hard when all you're seeing is a list of amendments. Does such a draft exist somewhere?
No.
Too bad. Thank you.
Mark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Tom, you briefly alluded to the prohibition on the use of certain data by regional planning bodies, and I was puzzling over that section. It appears on page 21, paragraph starting in line 10, and it says you basically can't use monitoring and data collected for monitoring and enforcement purposes, and I would interpret that as including VMS data as well, so that seems to have negative implications for the VMS-derived maps that have already been created by the Northeast Regional Planning Body, and I'm puzzling over that and wondering who has a beef about this and what their motivation is. Do you have any clue about that?
No. You are correctly interpreting that section, but I'm not sure what prompted it.
Rick.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to that point, based on some of the discussions I had about those references, I think that emanated out of a process in California whereby they entered into some marine planning work, and the VMS data were subsequently used to support a request for an MPA. And so the industry felt like they got burned on that. I think, you know, I appreciate the fact that you all have highlighted this as a concern because I share the concern. We expect to see potentially very significant offshore energy development in the Mid-Atlantic region. And ultimately, I think the best defense of the traditional uses of those areas by the fisheries and the fisheries resources in there is going to be a data-driven process that relies on accurate fisheries data. So yeah, I think if there's planning to be done in the ocean, it's critical that the councils be involved and that accurate fisheries data be used to do that.
Ellen?
Thank you. I had another question, but I'm thinking about the data use, and I'm thinking, and I know we're not wordsmithing, but if we have a problem with that section, we may need to say that in the wording that each council has the ability to allow the use of that information for regional planning so that it could be a regional decision rather than an overall arching decision for the nation. It would give us a little bit more flexibility in our region. But that wasn't the question I had. I was wondering about a little more information on the use of the information or lack of use of that the information for enforcement. Are we talking about fisheries, civil? I'm confused about what the definition of enforcement in that context is. Are we talking about everything or just one specific thing?
Well, we are confused as well. The way it's written, it seems to apply to everything. And it doesn't, if you read ahead to the executive committee's comments, it doesn't seem like that makes sense, that you wouldn't be able to use that information for fisheries enforcement, for example.
Thank you.
And some of this council's comments are followed up on a request from a scalper who lost his boat and was hoping to use a VMS for that. Dave.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I had a question for Tom. I'm confused on something here. It may be just that I'm confused. The changes to ACLs, we're getting rid of the word overfished and replacing it with depleted, which is to allow for natural decline, which I can see that. I get that. But then it also says an ACL cannot exceed overfishing level recommendations of the SSC. I'm not sure that the SSC would be able to assign an overfishing level because it's defined by overfished. And if we're not going to be using overfished, then how does the SSC do that? Am I missing something here?
Well, the changes in concert, I think, are intended to adopt what the agency adopted through the National Standard Guidelines. The current Magnuson Act says overfishing and, paraphrase, says overfished, the terms overfishing and overfished refer to fishing at too high a rate. And what the changes in this act, it keeps the language on overfishing as fishing at too high a fishing mortality rate. It gets rid of the term overfished, replaces it with the term depleted, and says the term depleted refers to a stock that's at a low stock size. It's more specific language, but that's basically it. So it actually more clearly links up the language that would wind up in the Act with the concepts that are currently in the National Standard Guidelines.
Dave.
Yeah, thank you. I'll be very brief. I was also going to ask a question similar to what Mark asked. I'm sure he was talking about dogfish, and it just seems there will be no allowance to – are we still going to use BMSY as the way of determining what overfishing will be? Is that how they're going to do it?
Well, I think the short answer is yes. There's language in the Act, and I'd have to go back. There's language in the discussion draft that refers to what they're now calling a depleted state as being when a stock size is below the natural fluctuations about the stock size that will produce MSY. So I think the answer to your question is yes, we will still be using some sort of BMSY or as proxy as a measure of the health of a stock.
Okay, so
and that if the stock falls below some level, it will be termed that differs from that, it will be called depleted.
So that would not necessarily be, for instance, what we now call 50% of BMSY?
The problem we have is the current standard that we have really is not in the current Act. The standard that we have and the approach of using 50% BMSY is in the National Standard Guidelines. Now, the draft discussion language brings that concept into the Act, that you have a stock size that's based on some relative metric related to the production of MSY. It doesn't actually say that it should be 50% of BMSY. And so I'm hedging a little bit because I don't know how the agency will interpret that section. You know, hopefully they'll stick with what they've already published, but there are no guarantees once we get through this whole process how that'll turn out.
Matt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll also be brief. I just have two questions. Is there any indication in your communications with Whaley that his assertions that any changes would not relieve councils of being held to rebuilding timeframes, the things that you indicated earlier that would not change. Is there any indication that that those assertions would be written into the act itself, or is this, are we just taking on faith that changes are not going to relieve us of the responsibility of rebuilding stocks, et cetera?
I'm not sure I can answer that. When you read the discussion draft, there are a couple times when I looked at it and I said, well, for example, the section on ACLs, where it says you can consider the needs of communities. And so we asked the specific question, well, does that mean we would be allowed to set an ACL that exceeds the overfishing level? And his answer is no. Now, because if you read the discussion draft, it doesn't modify the provisions in the Act that say you're required to end over. Well, it does modify. It doesn't eliminate the requirements to end overfishing. In some cases, it changes perhaps the time frame when you have to get that accomplished, but it doesn't eliminate the requirement to end overfishing. And so, you know, his stance is that we haven't removed the section, that piece in the Act that says a council will end overfishing.
Thank you. And you actually bring up the second question. Did he give any indication on how rebuilding time frames would be determined if we're going to allow flexibility based upon what? Is there any indication in your communications with him?
Yeah, there's a couple things. The first is that, I'm not going to get the exact language right, but the Act includes language that defines how you calculate the rebuilding period. And it's language that has been, versions of at least, have been suggested for a few years where don't quote me, but I think it says it's how long the stock will rebuild in the absence of fishing mortality plus one mean generation. I think that's what's written in the Act, but it's language along that line. Then there are some sections that say, okay, this is how you determine the rebuilding period. There are times when you can extend that rebuilding period for these reasons, and it goes into those reasons. And it does not specify how much you could extend it based on those reasons. You would have to, the councils would have to justify it, presumably.
Yeah, and I've got a series of comments, too, but I'll hold off for them.
Yeah, let's hold your comments. David?
In light of the clarifications that you've gotten from congressional staff regarding what's in this particular document, and how it should be interpreted, I'm now left wondering, and here's my question, what in this draft document that has now been clarified by staff would actually be consistent with the title of the reauthorization that they have suggested, Strengthening Fishing Communities and Increasing Flexibility in the Fisheries Management Act? It sounds to me that the text, what's being proposed, may not necessarily do that. It's a new title with a very significant change in emphasis to Magnuson. So I'm left wondering now, where's the tie-in with that title?
Offhand, I can think of at least two things that are in there. There's probably several more. I can think of three. The first is how you calculate the fixed rebuilding period. This particular act gets rid of that somewhat arbitrary 10-year period, and you calculate a different rebuilding period based on the biology of the fish. The second is the exceptions that allow you to extend that rebuilding period under certain conditions, for economic concerns and harm. There are also some provisions in there that allow you to phase in the rebuilding period over a longer period of time in order to reduce the impacts on fishing communities. The provision that's in the Act that allows for the potential of allowing an ACL that is closer to the OFL, I think that provides some flexibility to the councils on how to deal with that. Those are, I guess I'm up to four or five that I could think of pretty quickly. There probably are some others that are buried in there that I'm not as familiar with.
Mike.
Sorry. I wanted to go back to this issue of the council, according to this this draft, would be able to set an annual catch limit below the OFL. anywhere below the OFL, no longer bound apparently by an SSC recommendation on an ABC. I'm curious whether, in fact, there are any provisions in here that actually would remove reference to ABC in the Act. It's, the current version, it's only referred to in a minor way. The current version also only refers to ACLs, I think, once in a minor way. But is, in effect, what's being proposed here that ACL replace ABC as a concept?
There's nothing in the draft that removes the one reference to ABC that I think is in the Act. And I don't think the intent is to get rid of the concept of an ABC. I think the intent is to allow some instances where you may set the catch above the ABC because of unusual circumstances. Now, how all that's going to be defined, I don't know yet.
John.
I just want to make a general comment. I think we've got to be very careful getting into the weeds on this because, you know, this is the first draft in one branch of the Congress. So this is like the infancy of this document. I know Dr. Pierce made reference to the title. It's a politically designed title. That's part of this process here. So I think it's important that we're going to spend a lot of time talking about this section, that section. There's going to be a Senate version. There may be administration's version, so this is the early infancy. That's why the executive committee tried to talk about broad parameters and kind of bullets as opposed to get into fine words and commas and everything else. So I think we've got to be careful. This is a long year or a year and a half process that's just starting now.
Yeah, thank you, John, for underscoring my original comments. Are there any questions from the audience? Dave.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. David Gaethel, Fishing Vessel, Ellen Diane. Actually, I had three. The first was it says that a stock may be, a multi-species stock may be managed as a complex, which is a change. But then from what Tom just said, you still have to comply with individual overfishing limits. So how are those two, the question should be asked, how are those two going to interact with each other? That would be one. The second one is sort of a follow-up to that. Where does the mixed stock exception fall out in all this, and does it still exist? I couldn't find it in that markup. That would be two. And the third one was what you stated about NEPA, that any act done will be deemed to comply with NEPA. Is that just a declarative statement, or does it have further fleshing out somewhere as to what has to be done to declare that it's complied with NEPA? So those are my three questions.
Well, with respect to your first question, we're not sure on that stock complex issue. That was one of the questions we had, and the guidance we got back is that the Act doesn't remove the requirement to rebuild individual stocks of fish. So we don't quite understand how those two fit together either. The mixed stock exception is not in the current Act. It's in the current guidelines, and I think you're right. I don't think there's actually any language that addresses it in this particular Act. And with respect to NEPA, I think that's a good question. It's a declarative statement in here that if you if you write a management plan that complies with the requirements of the Magnuson-Stevens Act, it's deemed to comply with NEPA. I expect that we would get some guidance from the agency on what a management plan has to look like in order to comply with NEPA. I would hope that what we don't get from the agency is it has to look like a NEPA document.
Jeff.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, members of the council. I'm Jeff Kalin for Lunds Fisheries in Cape May, New Jersey, a vertically integrated fishing company with 12 boats and so forth. I'm not a member of the Mid-Atlantic Council. I'm not speaking as a Mid-Atlantic Council member. My question has to do with the whole sustainability issue that this council and other ones raised in the context of the Magnuson reauthorization. I wondered, when if you talk to Whaley, if you ask about that issue, we have been tracking this. We at Lund's Fisheries, we're international. Our business is international. And we're convinced that a U.S. sustainability seal could be used to replace MSC, for example. We're also members of the American Scallopers Association. And, of course, Atlantic Sea Scallops were just approved as sustainable by MSC. We felt if you can't lick them, join them, at least initially. But there are licensing fees, royalty fees, and so forth. So my question is, did you talk to Whaley about sustainability? It looks like we're losing this discussion nationally to the Pacific Northwest, who feel strongly you need some kind of a third-party reviewer to look at things like traceability and economic fraud and so forth, things that we're already certified for. Most U.S. producers already are getting having audits and being approved in those areas. So that's my question. And then I have one other piece. Point of information too. So, did Whaley? Do you guys get into sustainability? And if that's my question, so I'll wait and listen to the answer. Thing.
No, we did not. Our conversation focused on asking him to try and clarify the sections of the discussion draft that we didn't understand.
Okay. Point of information. We're represented by Rick Marks at Robertson, Monagle, and East, we being Garden State Seafood Association. Rick is going to be testifying next week with Chairman Robbins, I think. And he told us that when this draft was introduced as H.R. 3848 this month, there was a provision in there that would give the state of New York non-reciprocal full three-vote seat vote on the New England Council. So that's new to the draft that you've got in front of you. Okay, are you going to take comments later from the public, Mr. Chairman?
Yeah, we're in the question section.
Okay,
right,
thank
now.
You. That was my question. Thanks.
Are there any other questions from the audience? Okay, seeing none, Tom, could you go back to slide five and council members in the audience refer to Enclosure 2B, and we'll go through this section by section. So comments from the council on Section 3. David.
Well, I'm on the executive committee, so I participated in the development of some of this language. Actually, we discussed it, and Tom put together the language for our review, and it looks good. My thinking on Section 3 relative to flexibility in rebuilding is that it would be very advantageous for this council and for all the councils to focus on a national perspective regarding flexibility in rebuilding. And that national perspective has been provided in a very well-done report put together by the National Research Council, the National Academy of Sciences. The word national is in both of those titles. You know, their Ocean Science Board, I think, participated in putting together some great recommendations regarding what needs to be done, what should be done to deal with conservation of our fisheries resources off of our coast. I don't think any council member has before them now the executive summary of that particular document. I'll just highlight a couple of things that need to be incorporated into this draft document provided by the House, and I hope the Senate will do the same thing. This is a document, these are recommendations that I think have great standing. In past reauthorization efforts, Congress has used recommendations from the National Research Council. Why not? It's got credibility. It's not one group of individuals with a specific axe to grind trying to get the Magnuson reauthorized in a way that would favor them. This is a perspective that is national in scope, and frankly, it's a perspective that has been provided by many prestigious scientists throughout this nation. And this particular set of recommendations on rebuilding and flexibility includes the following people as authors: Patrick Sullivan, Jeremy Cawley, Dr. Michael Sissonwine, And it goes on to highlight a number of others, such as Ray Hilborn, Andrew Rosenberg, Brian Rothschild, Steve Murawski. So many prestigious individuals who have great ties, past ties, with the National Marine Fisheries Service, with the science part of the National Marine Fisheries Service. This has great credibility. These are individuals who are not now shackled or tied to a specific National Marine Fisheries Service position, and they can't speak their mind. They're now private citizens, for the most part, I think, able to speak their minds. And they have given us, along with many other individuals, a great perspective, such as fisheries managers could use additional management strategies to reduce and accommodate environmental variability and uncertainties of rebuilding. Currently, when rebuilding is going slower than expected, fishery managers may impose even stricter fishing limits in an effort to meet that deadline. If these managers could instead keep fishing at a reduced but constant level for a longer period of time, they could rebuild fish stocks while allowing higher harvest levels, alleviating some of the socioeconomic impacts on the fishing industry and coastal communities. It goes on to mention the mixed stock exception and why that should be used, why that should be expanded. As Tom noted, it's not in Magnuson now. It's in the National Standard Guidelines, but it's now being suggested as part of the reauthorization, the change to the Magnuson Act. I'm not going to get into the specifics. I'm not going to get into the weeds. All I'm going to say is, as noted in Section 3 in the document before us, draft council comments, there it is, findings of the National Academy of Sciences. I just would encourage this council to continue to use that language and then to embrace even more of what is in this well-put-together document that I think would go a long way towards enabling us to deal with some of the concerns expressed by Mark Gibson, some of the concerns about not having to deal with every single species in a stock complex, giving us the freedom and the flexibility to deal with predator-prey relationships, ecosystem considerations, dogfish, elasmobranchs, you name it, perhaps not to have windowpane flounder destroy the sea scallop fishery. You know, things like that. Well, little things. So I encourage everyone to read this document, at least the executive summary, and I would encourage us to once again embrace these recommendations that are very, very sensitive to the needs of fishermen, coastal communities, and, of course, the resource itself.
Dave.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, I was going to say something like what Mark did earlier, and my comment here very briefly would be that we're going to have to make sure of some definitions here in order to achieve true ecosystem management and recover productive fisheries. And the goal is basically to restore a productive food web, a food web that's structured in such a way that the excess productivity benefits humankind. And in order to do that, getting now to the dogfish, which I'm sure is what I know it's on Dr. Pierce's mind, and I'm sure it's what Mark had in mind. Whether it's in MSA or in agency rules, we're going to have to get rid of this being controlled by the 50% of BMSY rule. We're going to have to be able to, in certain circumstances, fish something down like dogfish, for instance, to below 50% BMSY in order to recover a productive food web. So I would urge us to make sure that however we do these wordings that now seem so convoluted, that be a part of the goal is to make certain that we are able to actually institute meaningful ecosystem management. And I've never seen how we could do it by being shackled to the 50% BMSY rule for every single species. So I would urge that we make sure that if we're going to go into a paradigm of flexibility, that be a part of it. Thank you.
Mike.
Yes. My understanding is you wanted to go section by section. But I would like to make a general comment as well, and I'm not sure when best to do it. If you don't mind, I just...
Yep, please.
Do it. Okay, so first dealing with Section 3, which is what you asked about. I do think that the wording in Section 3 is right on in terms of the way to go forward. I agree with David that drawing on the National Research Council report is a strength. A minor comment on follow-up to David's. He mentioned a whole bunch of people associated with that report. I think it's just in fairness. Some of them were authors. I was one of the authors. Some of the ones he mentioned were peer reviewers, not necessarily authors, but they all had an opportunity to weigh in one way or another. So anyway, I agree with the Executive Committee's language on Section 3. My general comment is that, well, a couple of them quickly. One is don't get too comfortable with staff intent. I've been through these things a lot of times. I can actually recall a time when a former staffer who was currently a high-level person within NOAA insisted that the agency's interpretation wasn't staff intent. So, you know, what's actually written is most important in the end of the day. So with all due respect to Dave Whaley, I'd read the text carefully. Okay, aside from that sort of somewhat perhaps cynical comment, my real concern is what's not addressed in this document. And there are probably three main things. Two of them have already been mentioned. One of them is the really the failure to significantly go forward in addressing the issue of the mixed stock problem and potentially the trade-off of a scallop fishery for a window pane that nobody lands anyway or something of that nature. And I do think we should have a general comment that without advocating a particular solution, that this is a real issue and it needs to be addressed in a more comprehensive and meaningful way. Second area is the ecosystem approach, and does in fact that the Magnuson Act, as currently stated, doesn't in fact allow councils and the public to promote an ecosystem approach in the manner in which we all talk about it very broadly. And frankly, I think it is an impediment to it. The third area is a much more subtle one, but it really gets back to the National Academy report, and that is I think that the way fisheries management is implemented under the Act right now fails to recognize that there are inherent limits to what science can provide and how much uncertainty there is in science and the inherent dynamics of ecosystems. So right now we essentially have a prescription that's described for sort of the best assessed and best studied stocks when ecosystems are behaving reasonably well. And it's a very good prescription for that situation. But that's probably only applies to about half the fisheries in the country or maybe less. And even some of those that we think are well studied and the prescription should work tend to break down on occasions for some unknown reason. We also prescribe ACLs or output controls for every stock, even in places in the country. This isn't an issue in New England, but even in places in the country where they can't even measure the catch, no less enforce it. So I do think there needs to be something in here that recognizes the need for flexibility that's consistent with the inherent limits of science. That is, what do you do when none of the scientists think you can truly estimate MSY in a meaningful way? And even if you did, it's changing. And what do you do when, for whatever reason, one can't actually impose a enforceable catch limit, which does exist in some regions of the country as a problem? So I think that's another area where, again, I would like to see a general comment that says the good intentions of the systems that's described and the concepts in theory may be very reasonable, but there's a practical limit to the implementation when one takes account of the realities of scientific uncertainty and enforceability of regulations and so on. And that flexibility to deal with those problems seems to be an impediment, in my opinion. Thank you.
Thank you. Tom.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. I'll restrict my comments here to just this section. I think, you know, looking at the comments that Tom's drafted, I mean, yeah, we're all for flexibility, but that's a pretty fuzzy concept. And in my mind, I think flexibility is always about balance, you know, that desire to be to have some discretion,
balanced against the need to have real commitment to rebuilding in a meaningful timeline. And my concern is that I'm not sure this draft strikes the right balance. As I read it, there's almost no instance where council would be committed to rebuilding on a specific timeline. If it's a highly dynamic fishery, if there's potential for economic harm, if it's a mixed stock fishery, if there's an unusual event, those seem pretty general. And I'm not sure that flexibility in my mind, and an appropriate level of flexibility, creates across-the-board loopholes or a lack of commitment to rebuild on any established timeline. So at the very least, I think we need to very specifically and narrowly define what an unusual event is, because around here they happen all the time. What a highly dynamic fishery is, because I think most people would tell you that they all are. What economic harm means, you know, rebuilding stocks sometimes means short-term constraints, and that's just the fact of it. So if we can never rebuild the stock by taking some of the pressure off in the short term, then we can't reasonably say that we're committed to rebuilding. So I just don't think this draft has the right balance. We're all for flexibility, but we need to have some prescriptive measures, whether it's a 10-year rebuilding timeline or something else, that ensures that we're making progress. I think at the very least what we need is, in the event that these exemptions are triggered, we have an unusual event or a highly dynamic fishery, well, what then? You know, what time frame, if it's not the 10 years, what time frame are we holding ourselves accountable to rebuild these stocks? You know, that to me, I think, is a minimum for, you know, being able to consider this as a productive step forward with the law. We have to know very narrowly when we're not going to hold ourselves to plan A and then what plan B looks like in terms of an actual time frame that we're committing to. I'm not sure this strikes the right balance. I do recognize that, you know, we're having an ongoing discussion about allowing for the right level of flexibility, and I'm not sure we're there.
Matt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm going to be brief. I support Tom's concerns about this. I think by divorcing this from any sort of accountability measures, we are setting ourselves up to kick the can down the road further and further and further and further. And as someone who looks at the history of this fishery over the long term, that's not what we need to be doing if we're going to try to preserve fish and jobs in this region. So I think having this section, the executive committee's dedication to flexibility, sure, great. I think having it based more upon a biological calendar rather than a political one, I think, is the right way to go. But I share Tom's concerns. We need to hold ourselves accountable to this. We've lost too much fish in just a couple of decades. We need to start bringing this back, and who knows what it's going to look like in the future, but the current draft that's on being discussed right now just doesn't hold us accountable and doesn't lead us in that direction.
Doug.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and as I think I might have pointed out at the executive committee, I think this is the most important section that we need to be focused on as far as changes. I do believe in flexibility. I also believe in being held accountable. I think in a flexibility standpoint, I fully believe in the National Academy of Sciences recommendation here about the removal of a fixed period deadline. We are dealing with Mother Nature, biological organisms. They don't react like a physical sciences, and we have to take that in consideration. Holding us accountable, where we need to be held accountable, is to end overfishing. That is our main task. Now, in a few extreme circumstances, I do believe we need to have flexibility from this need to end overfishing immediately. Those are very rare, and I think even when those cases are triggered, councils and NOAA Fisheries needs to be held their feet to the fire on it and not just use it as a delay tactic. So I think the 10,000-foot level recommendation here is good. The key will be, as this gets developed, is what are the fine details that are either developed in Congress or at by NOAA Fisheries when developing guidelines for this. So I fully support, as you might expect, what the Executive Committee came up with, and I hope the Council will support this.
Yeah, thanks for the reminder about the 10,000-foot look. Mary Beth and Ellen?
Yeah, I'll be brief because Doug covered a bit of what I was going to say, and I also would support the recommendation in this section by the Executive Committee, which could be perhaps slightly bolstered by Dr. Pierce's comments, but some of what he referenced is already here. And I think it's inevitable that we end up down in the weeds a little bit in our discussion, but in the comments I think we should be consistent with that. And I'll leave it at that.
Ellen.
I'll be very quick also. I completely agree with Doug, and I would love to see Dr. Pierce's comments added to the executive summary for your discussion. The one thing I don't see here is the flexibility that we are going to be needing in the future, I believe, as far as the changes in our ecosystems are occurring. And it's just a thought I wanted to throw out there, because as I read through everything, I don't see that we are going to have the flexibility that we need. I foresee some fisheries occurring in New England that have never occurred here before, and I'm not sure how we're going to deal with that. With that in mind, a deadline like we have now with the 10-year rebuilding will be disastrous, as it has before. So I think maybe down in the nitty-gritty, or maybe a little comment on the federal level that the temperature change is here and the species changes are here, and maybe we need to deal with that also in Magnuson. Thank you.
Any further comments from the council? Tom.
I just want to point out, I got asked a couple questions about mixed stock exception. I do want to, and I kind of forgot when I replied, I do want to point out that there is some language that talks about extending the rebuilding period beyond the statutory time frame. And I'll quote it: if the Secretary determines that one or more components of a mixed stock fishery is depleted but cannot be rebuilt within that time frame without significant economic harm to the fishery, or cannot be rebuilt without causing another component of the mixed stock fishery to approach a depleted status. So that it perhaps isn't as broad-based a mixed stock exception as we have sometimes talked about in the past, but there is some language in here that does provide some flexibility in those instances.
Follow-up, David.
Tom, just reminded me that there are many parts of the draft language that references the words, if the Secretary determines, if the Secretary determines, if the Secretary determines. And I think that, of course, the Secretary of Commerce, represented by the National Marine Fisheries Service, plays a major role without question. But at the same time, I think that many of these decisions about whether certain things could occur or should occur should be done by the councils, and we should not have to wait for the Secretary to render an opinion. That's a suggestion that I have, that if this change in Magnuson is to provide council flexibility, among other things, then let's make sure that the draft language is specific to that point, so that the councils can make many of these calls that I think we can make and that we should make. It's a bit unsettling to see the draft language and to see how, frankly, if this draft language was to be adopted, and I know it won't be, but if it is, the National Marine Fisheries Service is going to have a tremendous amount of work for it as it attempts to provide national standard guidelines that would enable it to deal with all of the if the Secretary determines. That's too much of a burden on the service and takes too much control and responsibility, I think, away from the councils.
Are there any comments from the 10,000-foot view from the audience? David.
David Gaethel, Fish and Vessel, Ellen Diane. I just wanted to highlight what Tom just commented on, because that's the section that I had underlined here. First of all, I agree with your comments on this section in general, but I would just like to add one more, and this would apply across all of them, and that is where they use terms like mixed stock fishery or mixed stock, that they provide definitions in the Act. This has been an ongoing problem from day one, where everybody thinks they know the definitions of the words, and we all got to go to court to figure it out. I think Congress should supply definitions. I think that should be an overarching comment on all these sections, that if it's going to describe the mixed stock fishery or a mixed stock exemption, it should define what it is. If it's going to define a stock complex or stock in the fishery, it should define exactly what it is so there can be no ambiguity at all about what's meant by it, so we don't have to fight over it all the time. I think that applies. The other one is to Mike Sissonwine's comment about the document. It would be immensely helpful if they would integrate the language into the existing document and provide the full document, because it's awful hard to say, you know, as an example, you delete semicolon in paragraph D and replaces it with a period in line 3A or something. I mean, we have no idea what that, it would take you years to do all this stuff. So that's just another comment that I would hope could be made to the committee.
Peter.
Peter Shelley, Conservation Law Foundation. At a 10,000-foot level, I think this is a terrible bill. You know, there's a saying that if you don't learn from history, you are destined to repeat it. And I look at the people up at the council table, and I think Dr. Pierce and maybe Councillor Martin were the only ones who were up there back in the 1990s when a lot of the issues that you are still struggling to this day in the ground fishery came because of the flexibility provisions in the statute back then. I remember Barbara Stevenson and others fighting over 1/8 of an inch in mesh size in an otter trawl for months, and missing the opportunity to slow the collapse of the ground fish populations. And I think we're reaping the fruit of flexibility that some of your earlier representatives sowed. In fact, I remember meeting with Regional Administrator Bullard, who was the mayor of New Bedford at that time, and I won't be able to quote you exactly, John, but I think the gist of your comments as mayor was, you had no idea what was happening inside MacArthur Drive. It wasn't a political issue at that point. Now it's a big political issue for New Bedford, and it's a big political issue because of the value of the scallop fishery, which has been rebuilt. And if you look at the fisheries that you want to emulate, they're the fisheries that have been rebuilt, not the ones you're still struggling with. And this bill goes in the wrong direction. There are the three provisions that the council letter seemed to be focused on were flexibility in overfishing and rebuilding situations, giving the councils control over NEPA, the Endangered Species Act, and the Sanctuaries Act, an ability to override science limits when there were considerations that justified that in the council's mind. As several people have pointed out, there's nothing moving fisheries management toward ecosystem-based fisheries management, where I think there could be a fair amount of common ground between the conservation community and the commercial and recreational fishing community. This bill doesn't do any of that. It goes backwards rather than forwards. I think the council, and there are people who have political experience on this council, recognize this, that you have to be careful what you wish for. And if you push for opening the debate on these topics, you're going to lose the control of that. And a number of these topics are going to bring in constituencies from around the country who have nothing to do with fisheries but care about the Endangered Species Act or care about NEPA or care about sanctuaries, and you will not be able to control the outcome in Congress. And the last two times you've gone through this process with Congress, the outcomes, at least from some of your perspectives, have been in the wrong direction in terms of producing more accountability, requiring science-based fisheries. I think those are good directions, but some disagree with those. I think this will be another situation. There is, I'll just, I guess, conclude by saying I think if you really are honest with yourself, there's lots of flexibility in the current law. Cod have been overfished since 1990. Since 1990, they've been overfished. The council has been allowed to keep that fishery open since 1990 in an overfished situation, and no one is going to be able to predict when it's ever going to be rebuilt. That is acceptable under the current law. I don't think that is acceptable, but it is acceptable. And that's the sort of measure that we would try to change if it were opened. The rebuilding schedules are still just a coin toss. Oh, yeah, you got this 10 years, but you get to flip a coin about the F rate that you set to get there. You know, I don't know there's a business in the country who would bet their strategic future on a coin toss the way this council does with fisheries. And then finally, I just want to mention briefly the NRC report. I find the NRC report very interesting. There's a lot of good information in there. I think there's a lot of there's a lot of valuable information in there. I also think there's a lot of cherry-picking going on about that report, and probably I would be guilty of it as well. But there are people who are looking for things they want to see and pulling that out and ignoring the other very strong, very focused recommendations on setting a very low effective F rate that you can enforce as a way of bringing back the fisheries. And those F rates, I know for some of the people who wrote that report, might be much lower than your F rebuilds. You know, I'd also say that the NRC report thought you guys got it wrong on yellowtail flounder, if I remember correctly. They thought your call that it was not overfished and not overfishing in southern New England was wrong. You got the science wrong. So let's use the NRC report for what it can contribute to the discussion and move us towards some of the fisheries that we want to have in the future, and not just cherry pick it to drag us back to the 90s where, trust me, I don't think you want to go back there. Thank you.
I think in order to keep this at the 10,000-foot level, we're going to move to Section 4. Tom?
So I guess this is a question for the chair. We had a lot of discussion about the draft text that the executive committee drafted, and most of the comments by council members supported the draft text, but not all. So how do we want to deal with the fact that we had at least a couple comments that, I don't know that they didn't support the draft text, but they at least made some qualifications. Do you want me to add a couple phrases to note that there were other opinions here, or how does the chair want to address that?
Defer to the council. Mary Beth, did you have your hand up? Or?
Well, not really.
put you on the spot anyhow.
I think that we should try to reach sort of a majority opinion, and I have a little bit of a concern of us stepping forward with, you know, different views in the same comments. I would encourage us not to do that if we can get there. And again, I think to do that, we really do need to stay at that sort of high level. So, I hate to suggest that we vote, but perhaps if anyone, maybe we could start with, is anybody opposed to the language as it reads?
Tom.
Well, to answer the original question, I think it would be worthwhile to at least highlight that we're not voting, we're not speaking with one voice, and there's a range of opinions with regards to flexibility. I think, as Tom said, you could probably change the text to say, you know, we support flexibility in rebuilding. We recognize this draft is trying to achieve or move us towards a better balance here. You know, and then we have the, you know, National Academy language, and then, you know, I think the rest of it is sort of fine. But I don't think it weakens our position to say we're a diverse group of folks as intended under the law. We have different opinions about where that right balance is, but altogether we can say we recognize this draft is trying to write that balance, and here are some additional considerations.
And this goes back to Mary Beth's original question of what's the purpose of today's discussion, and where is it going to go? And Tom, in my opening remarks, says we weren't sure. Mike?
Well, in terms of this Section 3, I heard some general reservations by a couple of people. I didn't hear anyone who specifically said they didn't like this language or that there was anything in it that was specifically wrong. But those general reservations, I think, actually are similar to a very strong reservation that Peter Shelley expressed, and that is just a fear that flexibility will be abused, as it clearly was in the past, as he stated, and as I agree, it was clearly abused in the past. And so that maybe somewhere in the council's comments there could be a sort of an overarching recognition that is an issue and a concern, that while flexibility has many positive aspects, there still needs to be a realization that it also creates the potential for abuse, and that in redrafting the Act, one needs to keep that in mind and maintain appropriate safeguards to prevent that from happening again. I can tell you in the deliberations at the National Academy or the NRC meeting process, that was clearly a discussion item that was before many of us in crafting the language. So it is a real issue, and it is a legitimate one that we identify as a concern, even if we might support specific provisions. It's an overarching concern. Thank you.
David.
Yeah, I support what Mike just said. I think it's a good qualifier. It's a good reminder. And frankly, you know, when I read the draft document, with all the exceptions that were stated, I thought it was too flexible. Would put this council, all councils, in a very difficult position, since those exceptions would invite all sorts of, attack, significant criticisms, and justifiably so, that too much flexibility would be given. So I think if we could incorporate the language or something similar to what Dr. Sisterwein has just suggested, I believe we'll be sensitive to the National Academy of Sciences document and the recommendations, and also sensitive to the concerns of those who feel that too much flexibility could be a bad thing.
Mary Beth.
Just to some of these comments, I think that, you know, the past, I think most of us are familiar with the past, and perhaps, you know, not progress in the right direction, and we had a bill come out that reacted to that, and I think this bill is trying to strike a balance, and I would hope that's the direction that we would be going in, that we're not going backwards, that we're actually going forward by striking a balance to some of the issues that we have before us today. And I think one thing that we could say is that we do need flexibility, but we also need to have progress in rebuilding stocks. I think we would all agree to that.
Doug?
Well, my comment revolves around the concern here of going backwards. Clearly, Magnuson in the 90s is very different from what Magnuson in the 2000s was, and Magnuson in the 2000s is very different from the Magnuson we have right now. So providing for a modest change in flexibility here, along with all the other things that are still currently in Magnuson that have changed since the 1990s, gives me much more comfort that we will not be slipping back. And so I think that we should continue to move forward with this recommendation, and if it's something that the council can live with as a committee, is there any objection to it? If there is, then we can note those objections to this.
Matt?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I agree with Mary Beth that we need to ensure that we move forward. And a medium, long-term view does not speak well of our attempts to do that. I think what also she's talking about, though, is a question of accountability. And I think if I could summarize what I said, and I don't know if Tom would agree with this summary of his statements or not, but this section, I agree, flexibility is important, but there still has to be some accountability to ensure that we do rebuild the stocks. I mean, the fundamental findings of Congress in the opening up the Act is that Congress has found that there are some stocks of the nation's fisheries that are depleted and overfished, and that needs to be fixed. Too much flexibility isn't going to get us there. Flexibility with accountability would.
John Bullard.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. You know, if we vote on this, I think I'll abstain because I think this is really a chance for the council to weigh in. And as Tom said in the briefing, it may be that the administration will come forward with an administration bill, and that's when the administration should put forth its views. I do want to say, Peter said, you know, let's not go backwards. I think about going backwards 1 year, just about 1 year exactly, right in this room, 1 year, we were sitting here contemplating what to do with groundfish. And you all remember contemplating a vote we had to take. This is where the Magnuson Act comes down to how do we face difficult decisions? And how does the Magnuson Act help us do our jobs to face difficult decisions? Are groundfish in trouble because of overfishing? Are they in trouble because of climate change? What does the science tell us? What's the uncertainty? Are they overfished? Are they depleted? You know, I don't know, but I know that 1 year ago we had very difficult decisions in front of us. Sitting right here almost a year ago to the day, we had really important decisions. We put it off in Newport in December, and we had to face the music a year ago at this table, in this room, everyone looking at us. And that's when you look at how does the Magnuson Act serve you. And I think it helps us think about the issue of flexibility. And if we'd had outs, you know, if we'd had outs, would we have taken them? Because that was really tough votes. And our job is to do the best to balance the needs, National Standard 8, National Standard 1. How do you take the issues of fish and fishermen, fishing communities, and do our job? And so I think as we weigh this, how do we do our job? How do we take those votes? What is human nature? Because there's always an easy way out. And I think, as I observe human nature, some of the times, you know, it's always easy to kind of put that difficult decision off. And sometimes what that means is while we do that, you know, fish stocks go down and the pain gets worse. But this council took a very difficult decision a year ago, really tough decision, and it reaffirmed it the month later or 2 months later, I can't remember. But I think one of the reasons it did that is because of requirements in Magnuson-Stevens. And so I just think as we think about reauthorization of Magnuson-Stevens, I think it might be helpful to think about how that played as practically every one of us was in this room a year ago facing that vote.
because that really crystallizes the job we have, the responsibility we have, that job we have, that vote. They're not all as tough as that one. But when you have to take that vote, no matter whether you voted yes or no on that, that's really what we're here for. And the Magnuson-Stevens Act, the provisions in it, are how it helps you to do that really tough task, how it helps you to do it. Does it make facing that responsibility easier or harder to do that tough task?
Dave.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, there's a lot to think about here. I have a couple of comments. The first one is I don't think we should be voting on this. I think we've arrived at a consensus. I agree with what Mike Sissonwine said and the follow-up comments around the table. I find all of them to be agreeable. I'm not happy with the idea of a vote right now because this is in an early stage, and I think that the executive committee has done actually a superlative job in crystallizing what we need to be putting forward at this time. And I think if we take a vote, it will wind up being constraining. And I'm not interested in going there. And I would abstain on any vote that comes up on this for that reason. And one thing I'd like to add to what John said about what happened a year ago. To me, the important point of all of that was that we took a very tough vote. And I remember that it, personally, I found it to be almost devastating. It was the hardest vote I ever took on this council. But it became a lot easier when I realized that nobody in the whole room could say there were more cod. There weren't any. And that's what we had to respond to. And Magnuson did make us respond in the right way. But there are some things in Magnuson that now are constraining us. And one of them that I've been saying all along is the 10-year arbitrary rebuilding time. It may be right for one or two of the species, but these are animals that have completely different life cycles, and I find that using time as the metric is the wrong metric. So I'd like to see Magnuson revise that and give us a more appropriate metric. I don't know right now what that is. Mike would know more about that than I do because that's what he's been doing. But I would like to finish my comment with something that was said last year at the NAFO meeting. Norwegian, head of the Norwegian delegation, Sigrun Holst, I talked with her about this, and she said that she's been following New England specifically and that we're going through what Norway went through 20 years ago. And she said they did make the hard decisions because what they discovered was that ultimately continued, and this is her words because I wrote them down, continued fishing on a collapsing stock does not benefit anyone. And I'd like to finish by saying that if you followed the news this week, Norway is booming in their fisheries right now. Booming, absolutely booming. They've pulled out of it, and they're doing very, very well. Their codfish export has tripled in the last half a decade, actually. And in the last 3 years, it's gone up over 20%. And they're seeing nothing but good times ahead. And that, to me, it verifies what she said, that continued fishing on a collapsing stock does not benefit anyone. And that's where we have to go as far as Magnuson is concerned. But the question is how to get there. And I find that there are problems with Magnuson that need to be addressed. And one of them is simply using the wrong metrics. Thank you.
PK.
Oh, I gotta limit my comments. We just stirred up a lot of things the last few comments. I agree in flexibility. I agree we should go together as a group. Flexibility doesn't necessarily mean going backwards. To me, flexibility can mean going forward. Biological or, in a mixed stock situation, it definitely, Mike mentioned it earlier about, window pane or yellowtail in the scallop industry. To allow more flexibility in a mixed stock association just seems more sensible to me than going backwards. So I think the more flexibility in Magnuson will allow that to happen.
Okay, John, last word.
Thank you. I agree with several last speakers, particularly Dave and Mike, about maybe don't have a vote, maybe put some general language saying this was not the unanimous position of the council. But I don't want to get too philosophical here, but follow up on what PK said. This bill, to me, gives the SSC some more authority. And that's what we're here for, to make decisions based on what comes in front of us. So I welcome the flexibility. We all come here to make a difference and have some input on the thing. So to some degree, we're almost saying, you know, save us from ourselves. Don't give us the authority to make decisions. We're spending a lot of nights, weekends, hours looking at this stuff, and I think we're the people that know where that balance is. So I welcome the flexibility in this. I've got confidence in everybody here. They're going to make the right choices. We come from different walks of life, different angles. We all know where people's interests lie, but at the end of the day, we should embrace the flexibility, not be afraid of it.
Okay, before I try to summarize this, look for nodding heads. Drew?
Thank you. Drew Mankiewicz, Fisheries Survival Fund. Just sitting in the audience, listening to this discussion. One thing, as a council, you should recognize too, I mean, Congress, when it's writing on this stuff, is very focused on Congress and the legislation and not necessarily on the real-world implications of all of this. And what Congress said, and I did it when I was there, is you think you can legislate away all the world's problems. And the fact is we all have to recognize that there's no combination of words that exist that will make ground fish better. There were no combination of words that made scallops recover. And so this is very early in the process. This has got a lot of rounds to go. A lot of different people are going to weigh in. But the impetus is to think, you know, right, here's our chance. We can get the words in place and make this all better. But the fact is, you know, Peter mentioned, you know, cod has been overfished every year, or overfishing has occurred every year since the 90s. I don't know if that's correct or not, but for the sake of argument, say it is. I think if you went back and looked at the record of cod catches as they related to the quotas that were assigned to the fishery, they were below pretty much the majority of the years. And so what's the issue? What's really driving our problems? Is it the legislation, or is it our lack of knowledge and understanding of the stock size and the catch? And that is something that Congress needs to understand, is all the words in the world aren't going to help things if we don't know how many fish there are and how many fish we're catching. And Congress needs to help on that more than anything else. And that's where congressional support has frankly been waning in the last few years. And, you know, scallops weren't brought back by legislation. Scallops were brought back by management decisions based upon science. And I think that really gets lost in all this discussion on rebuilding and what do the words need to say, is that yellowtail isn't going to get fixed until we know how many yellowtail there are. And that isn't legislation. And I think that needs to be communicated to the congressional staff, that this is all well and good, but we need all the help we can get in this other arena. Thank you.
Okay, this has been a good discussion, and this is what I think I've heard, that there's general support for the recommendation of the executive committee's recommendation, with concern expressed for maintaining accountability with the FMP rebuilding goals. Is that everyone's sense? Everyone okay with that? Phew, okay. Okay. Section 4, modifications to the annual catch limit requirements. Tom.
So you need to remember that the executive committee drafted this section before staff had a conversation with House committee staff. But what we focused on in this particular section is something that I think a lot of people have brought up earlier, is that to us, this section really has a lack of clarity on what it really means. And that's kind of what we say in these comments. We focus on the fact that some of these things aren't defined. It's not clear how it interacts with other sections of the Act. So this kind of addresses some of the council members' earlier comments about, you know, will this be spelled out? What are the definitions? Where are these things? So hopefully this one will be quick.
Real quick. Matt.
Thank you, Terry. I'll kick this off. I share the executive committee's concerns about this section, and I agree with David Pierce's comments in the letter that he submitted. There's a lot of ambiguity. There's too much ambiguity in here, and I think the executive committee's letter raises that in a constructive way. But frankly, I think the way the bill has this section worded is just unacceptable.
Ellen.
And I agree. It's very ambiguous. And I would think this is the perfect spot to really emphasize the fact that if you're going to make these changes in the Act, you need to have very specific definitions. And I think that's a really solid request that we could make, is that every one of the new wordings or schemes that we have in here have a specific definition, so that there's no ambiguity when it gets to the National Marine Fisheries Service and they need to put it into action. Thank you.
Is there anyone opposed to the recommendations by the Executive Committee? Any comments from the audience? Opposed? Okay. Tom, you all set?
Yep.
Thank you. Section 5, distinguishing between overfished and depleted. Council comments? Matt?
This one I don't support the Executive Committee's recommendation on, and it may sound pedantic, but as an academic, I guess it's my job. The term depleted is, I find, to be frankly short-sighted. It precludes us from considering why stocks are low in the first place. Overfishing, I understand the concerns about that term, but frankly, the term overfishing is the one term that allows us to identify clearly the one thing we can manage in that ecosystem, and that is our impacts upon it. So I do not, and I don't know if other people support me in this, but I do not support the substitute of the term depleted for overfishing. We need to recognize our role as top-level predators in this ecosystem, and that language that currently stands allows us to do that and forces us to take ownership of that.
My understanding, Matt, is it's not a substitution, it's in addition.
Either way, I think the term depleted is an evasion.
So, Tom, then Laura, then Ellen.
I'm not sure the Executive Committee's comment is clear then, because we really were supporting a new term but didn't really like the use of the term depleted. Not for the same reasons you mentioned, but because I think Doug was concerned that in ASMFC you used depleted in a different way, and we were confused about the confusion that would cause.
Thanks for highlighting that. Doug, can you help the non-ASMSC folks what we used for depleted?
Well, I think you could probably – this was, I think, was your concern, Terry, and my response to this was that this was a ASMSC definition, and quite frankly, I think the way that ASMSC is using it, which is for essentially data-poor stocks, may need to be changed, as opposed to – I felt having a different term or another term in addition to overfished. I don't think we're trying to get rid of overfishing. I mean, that's a term I think that is very clear. But the reason for this being brought forward is there may be, in some cases, it may not be fishing that's causing the decline. There may be, I think it tries to take into consideration the fact that climate change may cause some stocks to be at lower levels, not as a direct result of overfishing.
Laura?
Yeah, that would be my argument, is that, it might be overeaten, too, not just overfished. In the case of my friends, the seals, which you all know I hold near and dear. But I do think, I think depleted tends to sound a little depressing, as in it's never coming back. So I'm not sure I can come up with a better word at the moment. But I would disagree with Mr. McKenzie's assessment that the fishing is what's gotten us there, because it's not. Sure, fishing has had an impact, but things like water temperature and predation, there are other factors at play, environmental issues that have caused differences in stocks. And unless you're going to come out and call stocks underfished and give some credit for all the underfishing that's going on, I'm not sure it's fair to use the word overfished as to categorize it as a fishing issue. issue in terms of the health of the stock. There's got to be a better word. Thank you.
Ellen.
I'm going to agree completely with Doug, and I'm not disagreeing with Matt. But overfishing is an encompassing word that does not have anything that does not necessarily have anything to do with fishing. And I think that what this is trying to do is to put in a word that describes other states of depletion other than overfishing. And I think it's really important as far as the rest of the country is concerned and the public that we understand why there are no fish. If it's for overfishing, we need to know that. If it's from an ecosystem problem, we need to know that also. We can't just lump them into overfishing, into fishing, because it's the only thing we can change. We need to know, as a scientist, you want to know exactly what it is. I have no problem with putting in another word. I agree that depleted is a weird term to be using here, so maybe we could flush this paragraph out a little bit more to state that we more clearly that depleted was not the term we would pick. Thank you.
Mary Beth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would just say, you know, fishing is a pretty specific activity, and this definition is used as, you know, sort of a biological reference point. And I think that is why there's a push to change the name, not change what it means. I mean, that reference point will still be there. It just would be called something else. And this is a conversation that's been going on for a very long time. And in general, defining that reference point is important, but the fishing industry has felt insulted by the use of this definition by those who don't understand what a reference point is, and there is a need to change it.
Matt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This conversation, I think, highlights the dangers of using a term such as depleted. Stocks are not recovering as fast as we would like them, in part because of climate change, yes. The climate has been changing for a long time. We know that. Stocks have recovered in the past. We need to look beyond just single steps of causality here and recognize the long-term impact of long-term fishing on these stocks. Is overfishing the cause of all the low stock levels? Maybe, maybe not. But if we remove the term or augment the term with another one that's more evasive, we're not taking ownership of the fact of our role in shaping this ecosystem over the long run. The reason why climate change and other forces are having such a disproportionate effect upon our attempts to rebuild these stocks has a lot to do with the fact that these stocks are so low to begin with, and that has much to do with our fishing levels.
Dave.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wasn't going to get involved with this discussion because I think this one is how many angels can dance on the head of a pin. The problem here is I think we're looking at this problem from the wrong direction. And I don't know how you want to deal with the words, because words are important. But to me, it seems like the problem here isn't that we don't have a grasp on F. It's that we usually don't have a grasp on M. And the whole question is natural mortality, and we're trying to think up of another term for natural mortality. I don't have a problem with that, and if we can come up with a word, I'm fine with it. I wouldn't argue it one way or the other. But oftentimes what we do is we assign an M based upon whether it gets rid of a retrospective pattern and not on the basis of whether it has any biological reality. So I think the problem is more that we don't know where to assign M or what M is, and it's taken secondarily through fishing. And so I agree the term overfishing, I agree with Mary Beth, it certainly does come on as a slur to commercial fishermen. I have no question about that, and I'm perfectly on board with getting rid of it. But I think we need to look at a word to replace it from the viewpoint that we want to get people used to the idea that the problem here is M.
Other comments from the council? Drew.
Sorry, I was going to try and stay out of this one. This is an old chestnut, and this conversation is illustrating exactly the problem
this all really stems from the fact that overfish and overfishing are very similar but have sound very similar and easily interchanged, and are, it's very confusing using the both of them, and as this conversation has illustrated, because people interchange them all the time incorrectly. Overfishing is the rate. You're catching too many. Overfished is there aren't enough, and that's the biomass. Depleted would merely replace, in some cases, the term overfished as they weren't overfished to get there. They're depleted for other reasons. It doesn't change any of the legal requirements of what you have to do with that stock afterwards. You still have to rebuild them. It's really – it's part of the – you know, the Congress doesn't want to kick the fishermen and say they were overfished when they actually got there for other reasons. And that's all that's behind this proposed change. It doesn't change any of the response or the management decision you have to make once it is determined to be depleted or overfished. It doesn't matter how it got there. You still have to do something about it. And so it's really just trying to be more accurate. I mean, using depleted is also supposed to be simpler so that you don't have the overfishing versus overfished and all the confusion that goes with that. But depleted on its in its own also causes confusion with other acts, as a meaning within the Marine Mammal Protection Act, as it's used throughout all kinds of different statutes, that so it does get confusing no matter what word you choose. But to be very clear, if something is called depleted or overfished, you still have to do the same thing at the end of the day. This isn't unwinding any legal requirement. It's just changing the name, and people get very confused about that.
Dave.
David Gaethel, Fish and Vessel, Ellen Diane. The same as Drew. I was going to stay out of this one, but I can't. If you actually read, it says on page 9, subparagraph 8A, the term depleted means, with respect to a stock of fish, that the stock is of a size that is below the natural range of fluctuation associated with the production of maximum sustainable yield. So in this case, they have actually provided a definition. And I think, since I got a son who wrote about a 60-page paper on changing depleted, using the word depleted instead of overfished in a number of cases, we do in fact need to have these words defined, because I don't agree with what goes on in the next paragraph, if I read it right, which says that it'll, the entire act will be amended, striking overfished each place it appears and inserting depleted. Because overfished is caused by fishermen. That's I'll take responsibility for what I cause. But depleted can be caused by a lot of other things. I think cod are depleted on George's Bank right now. I don't think it's caused by fishing. I think it's caused by water temperature. And I don't think they're coming back. And I don't think if we shut the fishery down, they are going to come back until the water temperature changes. But fishermen should not be pasted with this pejorative word, overfished, which implies that they are the only thing responsible for the problem, when in a number of cases they are not the only thing responsible for the issue. So, you know, you could contact my son. I'm sure he'd be happy to provide you with a copy of the paper if you want to read it. But, it, you know, when it gets to journals and technical articles and things of that nature, there is a growing consensus in the community of fishery scientists that the word overfished in a number of cases should be replaced. And so I do think you should, as your comments have suggested, ask how exactly they want to apply these words and where they want to apply them and what they intend to use for definitions. Thank you.
Mark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Frankly, I think that both words are wrong sometimes and both words are right sometimes. And it'd be hard to, I think, thinking back about what Dr. Sissonwine said some time ago about what science can provide, not provide, the choice of the right word here depends on us being able to parse out the different sources of mortality, the different components of growth potential, all of the life history dynamics, you know, in a particular stock that leads to fishery productivity, to get the right word. And if it's most of what we're seeing is being caused by fishing, well, then it should be called overfished if it's a too low abundance. If most of what's happening, the dynamics are happening for some other reason, then we would call it something else. But getting the right word in the right any right situation requires an understanding of the dynamics of the stock that we don't currently have. So I don't really know where to go to this other than sometimes the words are right, sometimes they're wrong. Thanks.
Are there any further comments? I mean, looking at the recommendation from the executive committee, the committee supported the use of a term. To Mark's point, we didn't know what it should be, and that the use of the word depleted, as Doug was relaying, is confusing from those who work with the ASMC process. So is it a big stretch to say that the council supports the use of a term different than overfished and overfishing to follow Mark's description of what the status of the stocks might be? Tom?
Just to that last point, I thought we were specifically talking just about overfished, that overfishing itself wouldn't change because, as Mary Beth, I think, pointed out, it's...
That is correct.
All right. So, yeah, I think Mark's point was, if we're just talking about overfished, I think what's here is probably fine. I think Mark made a good point. You know, a lot of it really depends on, is situation dependent, and it may not change the outcome. So I can't get too wrapped up about, you know, whether we change the term or not.
Does anyone want to beat this to death anymore? Matt?
I'm not going to beat it to death. I recognize that I'm in a minority here, and so I will submit a minority letter expressing my concerns.
David?
Yeah, obviously I support the executive committee's recommendation, and one reason why I do so is that the current language in the draft actually forces discussion of depleted, the causes of the decline in abundance, and that would be on page 9, clarity in the annual report, where it notes what the report would have to do. And the requirement would force a great deal of scientific discussion as to what the cause of the problem is. Is it a cause? Is the cause due to too much fishing, or is it caused by something else, such as the environment? So that particular paragraph, I think, is important to be kept in if indeed the word depleted is going to be substituted for overfished.
Last word, Mike.
Well, I'm not sure it would be the last, but, well, it's up to you, of course, as chair, if it's the last. But anyway, I have some sympathy for the comments that Matt made, and but on the other hand, I think this is a legitimate issue of concern about lumping every time there's a low stock size as being overfished. I think it would be appropriate for the council to in some way acknowledge the concerns that have been expressed about multiple causes of low stock size, but essentially to comment on just changing the terminology to depleted may be confusing and needs to be carefully evaluated, something of that nature, which is in essence acknowledging the issue, but not going so far as to specifically be recommending this sort of wholesale change, which, as was pointed out, says basically substitute depleted for overfished everywhere in the Act, which I personally think is going too far.
Everybody comfortable with that approach? Seeing no objection. Thank you, Mike. Next section is Section 6, the Transparency and Public Process for the Scientific and Management Actions. Any council comments? Matt?
I apologize for rattling the hornet's nest again on this one. I think the council goes to great ends to make our proceedings available to the public, both to those who can be here and those who have to come into the web. And so the first paragraph I certainly have no problem with. I'm concerned about, however, the effect of any streamlining between MSA and NEPA. The NEPA process exists, as Tom points out, and as the executive committee points out in this letter, to inform both the public and the decision makers about the possible implications of it. It is in many ways the gold standards of transparency in allocating access and management of a public resource. So I'm very nervous and leery about any language that would like to streamline this in the interest of transparency. I think the two actually are opposed. You cannot streamline NEPA and still maintain transparency. So that's my opening comment.
Other thoughts? Mary Beth?
Again, there's been an ongoing conversation about these two things, and there was an attempt in the last reauthorization to do so much of this, and I think the agency interpretation was that it was unclear. I don't really want to say what the agency interpretation was. It's just the end result is we didn't see a lot of progress. So I don't think there's any interest in the public or in the fishing communities to not have a public process that brings all of the information to the table that is available for the council for decision making and for the public so their input could be provided. However, the overlap and just the timelines don't match up. You know, you have decision making that's confusing to explain to the public because of the overlap between the two acts. And I think that, as has been pointed out, this is an early, you know, discussion. I think the draft puts it out there so the discussion takes place. And what are the ways to best get it done? Because at the moment, it's not helpful to the public, this overlap between the two. It does create confusion, and it does create busy work that doesn't need to go on, and we don't really have time for that. So I think that's the intent, and I don't think we should try to get into it too much further. We should watch drafts as they come out. We should participate in the process, and I think that's fine, and I would support the language in the executive committee suggestions on this section.
Dave, then Ellen.
Yeah, just quickly, I agree with Mary Beth completely on this one. But my question here is, would this even be constitutional? Is this even possible to do in the act? I don't know. I'm not an attorney, but to make an act that deems itself to comply with a law that's on the books, I don't know. Can that be done? And if not, or if it can, then perhaps we need to make the MSA process meld better with NEPA, because Mary Beth is absolutely right, and I've been encountering this with the Habitat Amendment, the tremendous inefficiency that's involved in trying to make these two work together. So maybe the approach is, instead of saying it's deemed to comply, then say has to coordinate with it somehow. I don't know if it's even legal to do this. I have no idea. But that's inchoate, but that's my
Ellen.
Thoughts.
I completely agree, and I think everybody knows that I am really big on public process. It's the most important thing to me, to get as much input as possible. And I actually feel that the MS and the NEPA are at loggerheads and cause extreme confusion with the public. We need to meld them together and streamline them. It's really, really important so that when things go out to the public, that it is very clear on what they are commenting on, and the timelines are clear, and we don't have duplicate process, so we're not wasting staff time on things that really don't need to be done. So I'm very much in favor of this, Matt. I respectfully disagree with you.
Many do.
But it's really important. The public process is important. We need to streamline it. We have a problem between the two meshing together. So I wholeheartedly agree with this. The nitty gritty is what's going to be important, but we're not dealing with that today. So I think we should go forward with how the executive committee commented. Thank you.
Is there anybody who else is opposed to the executive committee's recommendation? Comments from the audience? Anyone opposed to the executive committee's recommendation? Seeing none, then you know, what I'm hearing is general support with a minority opinion. And we're going to unplug your mic. Okay. The next section. Limitation of future catch share programs. Council comments, Mary Beth.
I just had a quick question based on Tom's report. I think this reference, does it really change the definition? It included sector in the draft language, but would that include sectors in the way that New England defines sectors? I mean, sectors are used in different regions in different ways, and when this came up under, I guess this is a new section replacing LAPS or whatever, the interpretation was sectors the way we use it was not the way
it was used in the Act. So does this change that interpretation and that sectors and the way we see that in New England now fall under catch shares or not? Do you know, Tom?
Yeah, yes, I think it does. I mean, I don't believe the existing language in the Act uses the term catch share. It refers to limited access privilege programs. And the term catch share has generally been seen to be a little more expansive than either LAP or ITQ, and this language would incorporate the term catch share into the Act. So I think it would apply to if we adopted a similar program to what we have in groundfish and another fishery, that this would then apply to that. And I expect it was explicitly intended to.
So in general, I think I support the language from the executive committee. I just noted that, and we all might want to think about that as we move forward, but I wouldn't suggest we comment on that at the moment.
Other comments on the recommendation from the committee? Ellen?
I'm going to disagree with the executive committee on this one. I have no problems with the way it's written, and I know it's going to be rewritten many times, but I don't think that I obviously have absolutely no problem with the new wording and the new definition in Magnuson. Thanks.
Other council comments? Any comments from the audience? Jeff?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the council. I've been just sitting there listening and not trying to engage in every one of these issues, but I think that the idea of having a referendum before a new sector would be established is very valuable, certainly to people in the Mid-Atlantic region. We've heard that several times in the context of monkfish, so I think it's a good provision, and I hope that the council can support it. Thank you.
David.
David Gaethel, Ellen Diane. I want to concur with the previous speaker. I think we should have referendas. I think if we'd had a referendum in Amendment 16, we would have produced a very different document than we did. And the reason we couldn't have a referendum is because of the definition. As Tom said, it only applied to LAPPs. This specifically says sectors. And if the council doesn't want to endorse the language as it's written, I think that's a mistake. People need a chance to have a say to make sure they get a fair and equitable shake in any one of these programs. Thank you.
Jim.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Jim Kendall, New Bedford Seafood Consulting and Massachusetts Fisherman's Partnership. With reference to the voting issues that have come up in Magnuson over years with the referendum and the sectors and so forth and so on, one of the reasons that there was some direction towards referencing crew votes had to do with the question of consolidation. And would owners just simply override the issues of crews and go to a referendum that would allow them to consolidate with no input from the crews? So I believe that's one of the reasons that was in there. Another question that came up at about the same time with the same issues was the fact that how do you issue a ballot? Do you issue it based on a permit, or do you issue it on one owner, one vote? You've got some owners there that actually have a full majority within a fishing fleet that if they were allowed to vote for each ballot, would absolutely have control of that particular fishery. So they've been kind of silent on that, at least as far as I'm aware. And I think that needs to be decided before we come to that point again where we're trying to decide who gets the vote on what issues. Thank you.
Anybody else in the audience? Back to the council. Mary Beth.
So I guess one concern about this section, we see the direction that the conversation is going, is it can be extremely controversial. And I don't know, perhaps we might want to hear a few comments around the table, specifically to the language that the executive committee came up with. And, you know, if people are opposed to it, at some point we may just decide that we don't want to comment on the section. But I'm not opposed to it unless there's a strong opposition. I mean, we could go on for a long time on this.
Mark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On page 6, 14 and 15, there's a statement or a section there that says the cashier program can't be implemented unless it's first petitioned by a majority of those eligible to participate. So it almost seems like you have to have two referenda, one to get the whole thing rolling, and then another once you put together some kind of plan. And I don't think that the executive committee comments seem to capture both of those requirements, or it seems like that's such an insurmountable thing to accomplish that cash shares will just never happen, even if, you know, there are some people that want them.
Tom.
I think that section you're referring to is just for FMPs managed exclusively by the secretary, so that would be like highly migratory species.
Other council comments? With the exception of Ellen's strong position, is there other opposition to the executive committee's recommendation? Seeing none, we'll move it ahead with as a non-unanimous recommendation. Section 8, data collection and data confidentiality. Council comments? Tom.
I'll just be quick. I think the comments here from the executive committee are right on, outlining the value of having this information both in existing management and potential law enforcement and in planning in the future to make sure that, you know, we're at the table and we have fisheries fully represented, accurately represented in any planning processes. So I think it is a good piece of text.
Matt.
I fully support the executive committee's statement on this.
Well, we're going to stop on that one. Mary Beth.
I also support the language, and just as far as the limitation on enforcement use and the comments that the executive committee made, just seems like maybe just to add a little bit in there, because that would prevent us from using electronic monitoring for compliance. Which, you know, for many of our fisheries, if you want to go to full retention and use electronic monitoring, the language in here would seem to prevent that from happening. So I think if we could just add just a little bit, perhaps that example in there, it would help. And Tom's looking confused. Do you think? Oh, under, you know, using electronic monitoring for enforcement, the language in the drafts would seem to prevent us from using it for compliance purposes. For example, in a full retention fishery, that's the whole point. And so it just seems if we could just add a little bit of a text there to highlight that, it would be helpful.
Everybody comfortable with that? Is there any objection to the executive committee's recommendations before I go to Ron? Ron.
Ron Smolowitz, Fisheries Survival Fund. The Fisheries Survival Fund will be putting together a lot of comments on this, but my view is this section 8 is terrible. It's the number one thing we need is data, scientific information to better manage the fisheries. That has been mentioned time and time again. The problem that we have, it's very expensive to collect data. But this section, it doesn't deal with anything regarding how to improve data collection. It worries about confidentiality and law enforcement. And it does not provide a system to provide relatively inexpensive information. Electronic monitoring. It actually proposes that it should replace observers. I mean, you know, on the Albatross, we call that counting eyeballs and assholes. We're not doing any biological analysis with electronic monitoring. We're going out there now using RSA funds on a seasonal basis and collecting a tremendous amount of information on the biological condition of many of the species of concern. and about their habitat and the environment. It's costing a lot of money. All that information can be collected by commercial fishing boats at a much lower cost if we create an incentive program, a performance monitoring program, when we put in management measures. So I think there needs to be a major rewrite of this section. And this council has a lot of experience with industry data collection programs vis-a-vis sectors, for example. We should have something similar to market orders in agriculture, where you go out to an industry, you have a referendum. If two-thirds or three-quarters of the industry decide to set up an industry data collection program, then it becomes a government process where a fee is collected on landings and it pays for research. Vessels are required to provide certain types of biological data. I mean, there's a lot that could be done in this section, and this section is going to make it more difficult to collect scientific data at reasonable expense. So I have a lot of concerns with this, and I'll be writing about it, hopefully we could get some council support as time goes on.
Peter.
Peter Shelley, Conservation Law Foundation. I always like to get up and agree with Ron when I can, just to irritate him. Not on the specifics, but I think his points are really well taken. In Norway, a lot of other places are doing a much better job of accessing good biological data from the fleet. And this is just missing the mark by so much. I would also like to make a procedural point, Mr. Chair. Earlier you asked the audience whether anyone disagreed with the Executive Committee report, and I didn't get up. There's a lot I disagree with, and I think, just speaking for myself, I hopefully don't have to get up every section you go through to make those observations. Thank you.
Jim.
Jim Kendall, New Bedford Seafood Consulting and Mass Fishermen's Partnership. More than a question, comment is a question. Could someone explain to me a little bit more what may allow use of VMS for safety is intended to mean?
Tom.
Well, there is a specific prohibition in the current Magnuson Act which says that VMS can only be used by the Coast Guard in certain cases. For homeland security reasons, I believe, is the logic. Homeland security reasons are defined in another act and do not include search and rescue. Now, the Coast Guard, in essence, well, I won't speak for the Coast Guard, but I don't think they pay a whole lot of attention to that prohibition right now. But this would clarify that VMS information can be used for safety purposes.
All right. Well, in that case, I'd like to comment on it. First of all, a disclaimer is that I no longer work with boat tracks. I'm on an as-needed basis there. So I guess I have no more affiliation with them. But I've been a strong proponent that VMS be adopted as an additional safety measure for fishing vessels simply because it's a 24-hour system. And it's always on. It's always capable of providing some sort of safety provision for vessels out there. The other thing is that I'm a little worried about how some of this language is stated here, is that the information that's currently gained from VMS has been used in several different programs. One of the first ones was the access to the closed areas by the scallopers. At one time, there was a big pushback by the environmental industry saying that we wouldn't do this or we wouldn't do that as far as our actions if we were to open those areas. And close study of the VMS programs was able to provide proof positive, actually, rather than anecdotal information. And similarly, in that case, or in another case with the wind farms, a lot of the questions come up how the wind farms are going to affect the fishing industry and the maritime industry, and they're able to use the VMS information when it's provided to them to show the tracking and the access areas that these fishing vessels do
actually do use and accomplish there. So I would hope in those cases there it wouldn't be restricted or taken away from using that ability, because it's proven itself as a really good tool in some cases. But so I would encourage the use of further use along those provisions, particularly with, like I say, when there's such a large cost incurred by the fishing industry just for having them aboard the vessels. Thank you.
Are there any further comments from the council? David.
Yeah, I missed this before. In Section 8, use of electronic monitoring, it does mention that the Secretary of Commerce will work with the councils and the Pacific States Marine Fisheries Commission. I don't know why it's just the Pacific States Marine Commission. I would think it should be all of the individual commissions, such as the Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission. So in the interest of the partnership that we have with commissions, I would suggest that we note that it should be all commissions, just not the Pacific. Also, Ron did make a very important point, and I missed this as well, on page 16, where it says that if the secretary doesn't do what the secretary needs to do according to this draft language, then the councils would implement plans to substitute electronic monitoring for human observers, and the conditions for that substitution are not necessarily the best. The first one is electronic monitoring will provide the same level of coverage as a human observer. Well, to me, that's not a good reason to substitute electronic monitoring for human observers. There's no substitute for human observers. So the language seems to suggest that human observers will no longer be required, and we will just have electronic monitoring. Now, I'll back off a little bit with my expression of concern because of two, which says standards for electronic monitoring are in effect. So I'm assuming that those standards would somehow involve a consideration of when, indeed, there is no substitute for human observers. So perhaps the language that we submit regarding 8 would indicate that there should be some explanation as to what is meant by the standards for electronic monitoring specific to when would human observers not be necessary.
Mayor Beth?
So I agree with Dave's comments relative to the replacing human observers, because it's an odd statement to make because it's not possible. That will never happen. And also some comments from the public. It's not totally clear that BMS is considered electronic monitoring. Some people say it is. Some people say it's not. And so I think maybe in our comments where I suggested we, on the compliance issue, enforcement issue, that to also add it could complicate spatial management and leave it general might be appropriate. And then to the suggestion that we add all of the commissions, I think I would be slightly uncomfortable in adding all of the commissions in this section, in that I do know that the Pacific States has a specific program, which is why I think they're there. But I think it's worth asking the question where we're unsure why. I mean, why is the Pacific States, deemed in this section and others aren't? Because it's not totally clear to us on the East Coast that don't participate in that commission often, other than the fact that we know they have a specific program. So if Dave is comfortable with that, I would suggest we consider making that statement.
Yeah, Tom has a clarification question.
You guys lost me. It's not clear to me, David, what really you're asking for. The language in here says that a council may develop standards should the secretary not do so, and it says in accordance with an FMP. So it's not clear to me how that, if we develop it in an FMP, presumably we would address the questions you're talking about. So it's not clear to me what specific statutory language you think would be needed to add to this part. And
we're also drilling down below the 10,000-foot level.
Tom makes a very good point. I suggest we be guided by what he just said and not get into the weeds, as you said. So I'll back away from that suggestion, but also support what Mary Beth said regarding how we reference the Pacific Commission.
Everybody comfortable with that? Council generally comfortable with the executive committee's recommendations? Anybody awake? Mike?
I don't have any disagreement with the recommendations, but I feel they miss out on a lot of very important comments that have been made during this discussion. I mean, one of the things I heard is that perhaps there should be a stronger statement that simply says the council, you know, strongly supports increasing the amount and quality and timeliness of data collection as a broad statement, which points out that perhaps what's drafted here is too narrow because it really is only addressing a limited amount. I think it's also appropriate to say that the council, in that regard, the council would recognize the value of electronic monitoring, but that something that essentially reflects that there are limits to how far this should be considered as a viable alternative to human observers. I think that was another important point that was made. And I guess I'd just sort of make a more a broader comment that, you know, a number of the things that are in this section simply restrict the use of data, and I'd state it more strongly that that's counterproductive. So I certainly have no problem with what's written here, but I think it could be made even stronger about the importance of improving quality, timeliness, amount of data. As I mentioned, based on someone else's comments, the value of electronic monitoring, but the reality that there are limits to it. Thank you.
People comfortable with Mike's comments? Tom?
Yeah, I was basically going to agree. I think we can, without sort of highlighting too much the constraints of the EM, just talk about the value of both electronic monitoring and observers. But I think everything Mike said makes perfect sense to me and would be a positive addition.
Are there any further comments on this section? Okay, we're on the home stretch. Section 9, which is a council jurisdiction for overlapping fisheries, are there any issues with providing the council liaisons the ability to vote? Mary Beth.
Well, tongue in cheek, I think we should be able to vote in the mid, but they shouldn't be able to vote here.
With that clarification said, any further comments from the audience, from the council? Jeff.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I certainly have no problem with the provision. I just wanted to say that I think we all know that it came out of a request from the state of Rhode Island to get a seat on the Mid-Atlantic Council, and this has been under discussion for I don't know how many years, but came to a head over the last couple of years. And the compromise, I think, was the result that you see in front of you with the liaisons being able to vote. As I mentioned earlier, according to what our lobbyist is telling us, H.R. 3848 has a provision in there that would give the state of New York a non-reciprocal full three-vote seat on the New England Council. And I think that's something this council should specifically oppose in favor of the liaison compromise. Obviously, I'm from New Jersey. I think that, you know, it's a house of cards. We made this argument about Rhode Island coming into the Mid-Atlantic Council. Where does it stop? So because we're aware now that that provision is in the bill as introduced, perhaps this council would consider opposing that. Thank you. And that's just for me personally. That's not as a Mid-Atlantic Council member.
Any other comments from the audience? Mary Beth.
So actually, I do support both the New England Mid-Atlantic liaisons being able to vote at the table. And since we don't have a copy of a version that Jeff refers to, perhaps we could just word our language such that we think that this is a, you know, the right step forward in allowing representation from the regions to overlap and have a voice in voting, and use some general sort of, I'm not saying it exactly right, but I think, Tom, you probably get the gist of that, not saying, well, we don't want New York. I mean, that's a little odd to do, but, you know, we do know that this has been an issue in the past, and we think this is a good resolution to that issue.
Rick?
Thank you, Terry. Just to follow up, you know, I think the representation interest is broader than just Rhode Island. I mean, that was clear to us when we had port meetings throughout southern New England, just given the importance of some of the mid-Atlantic managed fisheries to the region. So, you know, hopefully this would, you know, while it may not satisfy every interest, it would facilitate that type of representation through the process. And similarly, in the mid-Atlantic, our largest fishery is the sea scallop fishery, and we're not able to vote all the way through that process given the current governance mechanisms that exist. So, you know, it would provide for some, I think, preservation of mutual interest for the regions throughout the process. But I recognize that individual states still have specific interests that they want to pursue. As Jeff pointed out, I think that's been somewhat of a perennial interest in New York, and obviously other states have representation interests that they'll pursue.
Mark?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I mean, as everyone knows, Rhode Island's preference is for a seat on the Mid-Atlantic Council, given the dominance of Mid-Atlantic species in our fisheries. But I certainly don't object to that as a starting point to recognize the mixing and smearing that's going on with fisheries, particularly in the era of climate change and species redistribution.
Any further comments? Okay. The next recommendation from the Executive Committee was to support the draft discussion language that would require fishing restrictions adopted by the sanctuaries to be adopted through the Magnuson-Stevens Act process. The Executive Committee felt that was important, but it needed clarification. Are there comments on this recommendation? General support? Comments from the audience? Okay, we're on the last one. The Executive Committee supported the draft discussion language that would require any fishery management restrictions needed to implement Endangered Species Act recovery plans to be implemented through the Magnuson-Stevens Act process. People comfortable with that recommendation? Mike?
I don't know what it means, really. Let's say under ESA there's a Section 7 consultation that says, you know, there's something that must be done in order to be compliant with ESA. And the process right now is that unless something has changed, the preferred route that the agency has is that to go to the council and ask that the council adopt regulations to be compliant with the requirements under ESA. So does this mean that the ESA would not actually have any effect, and if the council didn't act, there wouldn't be any requirement to be compliant with ESA? Or does it mean whatever the ESA determination is, it sort of automatically becomes a Magnuson Act requirement? So I don't know whether what this means and whether it in fact solves any problems or makes more problems. I would also comment note the comment that Peter Shelley made about if this is in there, you can bet on this being a much bigger issue than any of us are involved in the fisheries world. So I'm not, because of all this lack of clarity and frankly the likelihood, in my opinion, that it's not going to get enacted, I'm pretty leery about opening the Pandora's box on this one.
Mary Beth.
Well, I agree with Mike that it's too general and we don't want to open a Pandora's box, because I had an idea in my mind what I thought it meant, but that might be wrong. And so I think it's important. And for those of you who have gone to the Council Coordinating Committee or read the reports, have not been there, but I know that in the North Pacific in particular, this has been a significant issue in what is the process. And I think if there's a way to define the process of how the councils interact in developing or making recommendations on you know, the output of a biop, and when you receive the biop for review and you get to make comments and things like that, I think that's where the improvement is needed. And so, and I think if you're clear, then maybe then you're not opening the Pandora's box. You're defining a process. And so I think just a general comment on the lack of clarity in this section would be helpful.
Ellen.
I'm not disagreeing. I just was wondering if Tom could tell me if this would change, this change in Magnuson would have changed the dolphin take reduction process as it stood.
Well, I'm not sure.
Okay, thanks.
Matt.
I share Mike's concerns about this. I think it's vague, and it promises to be indeed a Pandora's box on this one. I'm also not sure whether it's legal. I mean, earlier there was a comment made about another issue in NEPA, and I dredge that up and issue it here that there needs to be a lot more clarity on this one before I can get behind it.
Well, this is an issue that's been championed by the Western Pacific Council. Further comments? Drew?
Thank you. This is an issue that's actually come to the fore quite a bit in the scallop fishery because of turtles. Whether or not, I'm not going to get into the politics of it or its likelihood to succeed, to the question of whether or not it's illegal, if it doesn't violate the Constitution, Congress can do it. So let's just settle that debate. But right now you have two different lines that require different measures for on scallop dredges that affect turtles. You have one line that says when you have to put on turtle chains and one line that says when you have to put on turtle dredges. You guys put in the line with regards to turtle dredges, but the line for chains is done by the agency through the Endangered Species Act. And so any attempt to actually harmonize those lines is complicated by that very fact that the regulations were promulgated under two different acts. When we have RPMs that come out with the biological opinion, there's a lot of confusion about how to actually implement them in the fishery because they're coming out of the Endangered Species Act and how to. So this is a very real issue that there needs to be more discussion about how to harmonize when you have a biological opinion that says you have to do something within a fishery and you have one part of the agency that frankly doesn't talk very well to the other part of the agency, and then it all comes to a head here on how to actually implement it. So it's something that needs to be discussed further. I don't know if what's actually proposed in the act is workable or is really the solution, what's being proposed, but they have identified a real issue that has real ramifications here in New England and throughout the country that deserves at least a discussion. And I understand that there are a lot of people that come out of the work with ESA, but it is a real issue that has real ramifications here.
Other comments? So how are we going to wrap this up? It's a... Yeah, Tom?
So based on the comments around the table, my suggestion here would be to revise that very last paragraph to say something along the order of, we're not really sure what it means. We think there's a need to better link ESA and the Magnuson-Stevens Act, but we're not sure if this language does that.
People comfortable with that? Tom?
Yeah, I'm comfortable with that. I was going to make a different point, and that is that I think there's a lot more to be done, and a lot of us would support a broader discussion of ecosystem management in this reauthorization. And as I look at the text, I think it's only referenced once, and it's in Section 4, and there's just not a lot to it. I think given our discussions about that here at this council, and I know other councils are discussing that as well, this reauthorization may be the place to start talking about definitions and goals and offering some guidance, or at least considering doing that. So maybe in our comments we could reference that, at least what I see to be a bit of a gap, and say, you know, we really encourage revisions or additions to this that start to spell out what we mean by ecosystem-based management and what tools we're going to have to get there. So I just offer that as an addition to the comments we've made.
John.
Yeah, that was the point I was going to make, is that I congratulate the council on concisely coming up with comments on what's in the bill. And Tom has talked about, and Peter Shelley made some comments about what isn't in the bill and how do you react to what isn't in the bill that the council has also spent a lot of time and effort and work in. And do you make comments about what isn't in the bill? And ecosystem-based management would be one area. And do you want to comment on something that isn't in the bill? And by suggesting that, hey, this is an issue like ecosystem-based management that clearly is a direction we as a council are moving in. It's part of our future. And here are thoughts on that. And I raise that as a question, commenting. Errors of omission, if you see it that way.
And bearing in mind that we don't have the Senate version or the administration draft to react to either. Doug.
And that kind of brought up a question that I have when the committee chairman asked for comments on a bill. And do we have the authority, without getting into lobbying, to comment on what we don't think is in the bill? And I guess I turn to the legal comments. If we can, that's great, because I had sort of limited my comments at the executive committee based on what was in the bill.
Gene.
Yeah, I think that's – I was thinking the same thing when the previous comment was made. Is it somewhat depends on what the House asks you to comment on, which I don't have in front of me. I think if they ask, there's a possibility you could be going over the line if you start just, for the sake of lack of a better word, lobbying for things that aren't in the bill, that are not somehow connected with what is in the bill. Just totally a new kind of concept, perhaps. I think as long as what you're saying is, or what you're commenting on, is somehow related to what's in the bill and might be a better way to approach the issue that the bill is trying to address, I think that would be appropriate.
Tom.
Yeah, and I think the opportunity to do that is in Section 4, where it talks about considerations of ecosystem impacts. I think we just say, you know, this is briefly raised in the existing bill, and we've discussed it. We know other councils have. We think that it deserves a much broader conversation and perhaps, additional definitions or goals or guidance, and that this reauthorization could be the opportunity to do that. But I think the way in is because it specifically references ecological impacts, and it's starting to get there, and I think our comments would be, we support that. We support that conversation. We support, broadening the scope of the treatment in the draft.
Chairman Rick.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think furthermore, it's worth noting that your prior chairman testified at the invitation of the committee on a number of items that are not perhaps reflected in the bill or in the draft language. Among those, the sustainability certification is not addressed. One other thing that's not in here that I think may be of interest to both councils is the fact that your council and ours both work towards developing cost-sharing mechanisms for observer coverage. That authority is not specifically in the Act. In Section 313 of the Act, as it's currently written, the North Pacific Fishery Management Council has significant discretion, I think, in developing their observer program, observer coverage rates, et cetera. And that same privilege is not extended to this region or other councils around the country. So recognizing this is going to be an iterative process, I think having that addressed, that is some more tools for funding observer coverage and specifying observer coverage levels in our FMPs is something that ought to be of interest either at this stage or subsequently, because in light of those disapprovals on our respective amendments, I think that's something that still needs to be addressed. We've tried to discuss workarounds, but ultimately perhaps that could be addressed through the Act. But again, the sustainability issue is not addressed. And that's something that we're going to be interested in pursuing as well.
John.
Being very careful not to cross over the lobbying line, I think that if we really want our thoughts to be heard, that we make sure that we send a copy of this letter to all members of the New England Congressional Delegation, and if there's something in particular that we really reinforce that. I think, you know, to be the cynic here, this is probably a letter sent out to all councils to gather as much information, and unless there's somebody pushing our views a little bit, it might just be sitting there on the table. So I'd make maybe a kind of a sense of the meeting that we should send it to all members of the New England delegation.
Are there any further comments? Tom?
I just have a couple. One is there have been a couple ideas thrown out here at the end. I want to make sure I know whether to add them in or not. The issues that seem to be absent that we've raised before. Committee staff seems to be interested if there are things that we think are missing that need to be addressed, particularly ones that we perhaps have raised before, like the sustainability certification, EBFM, and that type of thing. So I'm not sure they view it as lobbying. I look at general counsel here for that. And the other thing is that one of the things that we haven't gone into, and I just want to get your concurrence, is that sometimes it's helpful for the committee staff if we give them specific examples to illustrate our points. Presumably you have no problem if Chris and I deal with the committee staff as long as we don't go beyond what you've suggested. And just give them specific examples, for example, of how these things might benefit our region if they were used, or how things have hurt us. For example, the data confidentiality problems, that's something that they're not really familiar with, so we could probably give them examples to show how the provisions have hindered our ability to pursue some management options. So I guess there were three points there. One, I want to make sure I know which one of these general points people want me to make. I'm assuming they want me to make the one somehow fit it in on the EBFM, somehow fit in the sustainability certification. The one that I'm a little unclear on is the one that Mr. Robbins raised about observer funding issues, which has been a problem here.
Everybody comfortable with adding all those in? Mike?
I'm comfortable with adding those, but I mentioned three at the beginning. One of them was the ecosystem area. Another one was pretty esoteric about science and variability, so I'll drop that at this point. But I do think the mixed stock problem is a real issue that we should acknowledge or should raise, because it's, you know, it's touched on in various things in the Act, but it doesn't really help much. It could be included broadly as in some comment about ecosystems, but I do think more needs to be done to address the mixed stock issue.
Everyone agree? Jeff, I'm assuming your comment was in support of the sustainability? Okay. Are there any further comments? Ellen.
Just really quickly, I just want to reiterate that asking for specific definitions, I think, is a really important issue, and I don't think anyone disagreed with that.
Okay. Well, I think I'm going to thank everybody for a long and thoughtful discussion. We're going to break for an hour. It's try to be back at 1:55. For those who want to eat at the restaurant here, they are providing a buffet.
So. So.